We have one case scheduled for our 10 o'clock docket. I'm going to call the case, and we'll proceed right with that if counsel are here. The case is People v. Sarah or Sarah. Are counsel here for that case? Counsel for the defendant, could you tell me how he pronounces his name, please?
Sarah.
Sarah. Okay, thank you. Let me just review briefly our procedures. Please sit down. We have an argument. If the appellant wants to reserve time for rebuttal, you can tell from the digital clock how much time is left. We also have color-coded timers. They go from green to amber when 5 minutes are left to red when your time is up. You should know that we've had a chance to read the briefs, and at least one of us has had an opportunity to review the record. You should also be aware that we're recording the oral argument, so if there's any confidential or private information, you may want to be careful as to how you refer to that. And you should know also that the podium has a toggle switch that you can use to raise or lower it if you think that would be helpful to you. So with that having been said, we're ready to hear the argument in People v. Sarah.
Good morning, I'm Allison Ruttenberg, ADC counsel for the defendant appellant in this case, Imhotep Sarah. Mr. Sarah was convicted of sex assault upon his estranged wife, LV, and he filed a Rule 36 motion raising various issues, one of which went to an evidentiary hearing, which is on appeal today. And the key issue in this case is whether the district court erred in holding that trial defense counsel in this case made a strategic decision not to call the victim's aunt, thus defeating the defendant's ineffective assistance of counsel claims. The defendant relies on Wiggins versus Smith and Ramones versus Burgess for the proposition that an investigation leading to the choice of strategy must be reasonable. Otherwise, the strategic choice is kind of erected upon a rotten foundation that comes tumbling down. And in this case, there was no investigation. There was no credible evidence of an investigation of the victim's aunt, even though trial defense counsel was told by the defendant that the victim's aunt could have key evidence, and that forms the basis for his ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Pardon me, Ms. Ruttenberg. I'd like to ask you a question about the claim that you make that there was no investigation. As I understand it, trial counsel testified at the post-conviction hearing that she recalled the defendant providing her with the information, specifically the information that the victim had spoken with this witness, and the victim allegedly had said, this didn't happen, and also suggesting that if the defendant would get rid of the new woman in his life, she would make the charges go away. I am obviously paraphrasing. There was testimony that the counsel was aware of that counsel sent an investigator out to investigate that, and that there was no report in the file because of some computer problem that occurred when the public defender's office moved locations. Now, on our review, obviously, we review issues of law de novo, but we also review issues of fact in this context, historical fact, for clear error. And my question for you is this. Because there is that testimony, and I understand that there was contrary testimony, and I understand that there was an expert who testified that's not the way it runs, but nonetheless, there was this testimony and the court chose to credit it. How does that shape what we must do now?
Well, to the extent there was a finding of fact that Ms. Hoskins was in fact interviewed, that was an abuse of discretion for the following reasons. First of all, the investigator never testified that he clearly remembered interviewing her. He just testified that he thought maybe he did. And he noticed that the girlfriend and the aunt have similar first names, Joyce and Janice, and they're easy to confuse, especially when you're trying to remember after 7 years. I kept confusing their first names. In fact, in a reply brief, I referred to the aunt once again as Joyce Hoskins rather than Janice Hoskins. Second of all, the fact that there was a computer problem doesn't doesn't even make any sense, because all of the other investigators' reports were printed out and were in paper format in the file. So some sort of transfer of the physical plant of the public defender's office years later, and there was some sort of computer problem, that doesn't affect the transfer of the paper file. All the investigators' reports were printed out and put in the paper file, and there was no report at all that any investigation happened of this particular witness, and there was no email printed out that in the file, and there was emails regarding all these other issues that were printed out in the file. There was no email in the file requesting that the investigator go out and investigate Janice Hoskins. There was just email that he was supposed to go out and investigate Joyce Singleton, the girlfriend. And the expert testified that it was public defender policy to have an email requesting the investigation, and it was public defender policy that you then have a written report, none of which existed in the file.
Are you saying there is a basis in the record for us to conclude either that trial counsel lied or that her testimony was credible as a matter of law?
Her testimony wasn't credible. She didn't lie. What she said was that Ms. Hoskins, quote, must have had something negative to say or I would have called her as a witness, unquote. She couldn't remember anything. She's just speculating that maybe she had something negative to say or I would have called her as a witness.
But she testified, didn't she, that she had this witness interviewed, right?
No, she didn't. She said she thinks she had that witness interviewed. There is no clear testimony from the defense counsel that there unequivocally was an interview with this witness. She just thinks that it must have happened. Now, Ms. Hoskins was extremely clear in her memory, no, I was never contacted by Dana Casper. And she would have remembered that because Ms. Hoskins was previously represented in her own felony case by Ms. Casper, so she knew who Ms. Casper was, and she unequivocally testified, I was never contacted by Ms. Casper or anyone acting on her behalf. Therefore, I don't think there's any credible evidence in the record that this witness interview took place, and therefore trial defense counsel neglected to interview this witness. And neglecting to interview this witness is ineffective assistance of counsel because this turned out to be a very key witness. Unfortunately, I couldn't argue that some very specific things that Ms. Hoskins testified to, that the victim admitted to her that she lied in order to get even with the defendant for having an affair, because the defendant didn't even know that much when he told his defense counsel to go interview this witness. He knew that she had some important things to say, but he didn't know that all of the important things that she had to say, because he was incarcerated and he couldn't talk to her directly about his case. So there is no newly discovered evidence, because this evidence would have been available to trial counsel back during the trial in 2001, had trial counsel diligently investigated the case. So therefore, it was ineffective assistance of counsel to neglect to interview this witness, and had this witness been properly and thoroughly interviewed, there would have been evidence that the victim lied, that the victim admitted to a witness that wasn't on the defendant's side, so to speak, but was on the victim's side, because this is the woman who raised the victim from childhood. that the victim was lying, that she admitted to lying, that she had a motive to lie, and that she was extremely angry at the defendant for having an affair. And the defendant was prejudiced by the neglect of his trial counsel, because this whole case turned upon the testimony of the victim. There's very little other evidence in this case. There's evidence that the victim was engaged in some sort of a scuffle, but her physical injuries were very minor, a minor abrasion, and the doctor who did the rape kit testified as to a slight tear in her perineum. But he also testified that sort of injury is consistent with consensual sex as well as non-consensual sex. I don't think there's any debate here that that the victim and her estranged husband engaged in sexual intercourse at some point. I mean, the sole issue was whether that was a sex assault or whether it was consensual. Therefore, I think that there was sufficient evidence in the record to conclude that to the extent the district court made a finding of fact, which he didn't really clearly make, but to the extent he did, that trial defense counsel did in fact interview this witness and did in fact make a reasonable decision not to call her, not just what defense counsel testified to, I can't remember, she must have had something negative to say or I would have called her as a witness. But to the extent he made that finding of fact, it was an abuse of discretion, and therefore he misapplied the law of ineffective assistance of counsel, that trial counsel did neglect the defendant's case, and that there is, and that had this evidence come to light, the result probably would have been different given the lack of other evidence in this case, and therefore the defendant was prejudiced by this failure of his trial defense counsel to investigate. If the panel has no further questions at this point, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, very well, Ms. Ruttenberg.
May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Rhonda White, attorney registration number 35996, and I represent the people in this matter. The sole issue on appeal is whether the record supports the post-conviction court's determination that trial counsel made a strategic decision to not further investigate or call at trial witness Janice Hoskins, who was a parental figure to the victim and had raised her since she was a teenager. To establish the denial of the effective assistance of counsel, a defendant is required to show both that one, counsel's performance was deficient, and two, that such deficient performance prejudiced the defense. I would like to first address whether counsel's performance was deficient. Counsel's performance is presumed, and courts indulge a strong presumption that counsel's conduct falls within a wide range of reasonable professional assistance. It is defense counsel's function to decide what strategy to employ, and the decision not to present certain evidence or witnesses may constitute a reasonable strategic choice. The right to effective assistance of counsel is not a guarantee against mistakes of strategy or exercise of judgment, and judicial scrutiny is highly deferential. Here, counsel's performance was not deficient. As trial counsel testified at the evidentiary hearing, the defendant never told counsel that Hoskins would have testified that the victim may have fabricated the rape charges. In fact, the defendant only told trial counsel that the victim had told Hoskins that she would drop the charges if the defendant stopped seeing his mistress, Miss Singleton, and that the victim lied about not seeing the defendant on certain dates.
Ms. White, Ms. Ruttenberg says, in her reply brief, that the defendant didn't know all of that information, so he couldn't have told his trial counsel about the fabrication story, but his contention is that if the trial counsel had in fact investigated properly, that she would have found out that information. What is your response to that?
Well, I think the first part is that the reasonableness of an attorney's decision to not further investigate is directly related to the information that the defendant supplied. However, here, as the post-conviction court held, the decision not to call Hoskins was based on strategy, because the post-conviction court heard both Hoskins and trial counsel's testimony at the post-conviction hearing, and the court recognized that both Hoskins and trial counsel had difficulty remembering events from 2001 and 2002. but it credited trial counsel's statements that it was certain that she was certain that her investigator had interviewed Hoskins, as well as her recollection of a phone call with Hoskins where she recalled that there was something negative, and that clearly indicates her strategic decision.
So, pardon me for interrupting, Ms. White. You disagree with counsel's statement about the status of the record.
I mean, I think that the post-conviction court listened to both trial counsel and Hoskins. So, in my perspective, even though the post-conviction court heard all about, you know, this lack of written notation, it found that insufficient to discredit trial counsel's testimony. And as it held,
pardon me, but according to the defendant, trial counsel stated, "Well, maybe I may have interviewed this witness." Your position was that the record indicates that the trial counsel said that she did interview the witness.
I think her statement was that she was certain her investigator interviewed Hoskins and that she recalled a telephone conversation.
That she had with Hoskins.
So that is my recollection of the record.
Thank you.
Counsel, can I ask you a little bit about this something negative to say? Was there any testimony about what this something negative related to? Was it the three-way conversations between Hoskins and the victim and defendant and the fact that he was in custody? Was that the negative, something negative to say? What was that?
There wasn't anything specific. And like the post-conviction court held, both Hoskins and trial counsel had difficulty remembering the events because the hearing was held in 2009 and the trial was in 2002. So we don't have the specific indication of what was negative. However, I think if you look at Hoskins as a witness, she had a criminal background and she also was a risky witness because she had a very close relationship with the victim. So while she may have testified against the victim, there's always the risk that she would have testified and strengthened the victim's credibility.
What troubles me, I guess, is when you make a strategic decision, there has to be some kind of reason for it.
Right.
And without being able to articulate a reason for a particular view, how do you decide that there was a strategic decision actually made?
Well, I think that as the post-conviction court held, I mean, trial counsel's duty is to represent the defendant to the best of her ability. And so by having something that stuck out that was negative to this witness, and she had several other witnesses to call that would have testified to the same thing that Hoskins would have testified to.
But not to the retraction of charges.
But we at that point, she didn't know that Hoskins would have testified to that. And there's no indication. And further, defendant and Hoskins had several telephone conversations in order for him to communicate with his daughter. And the defendant never told trial counsel during that time that this was going to come out, that the victim had recanted her story.
But I don't think the victim told him that or told
no,
Hoskins. And Hoskins didn't say that she told defendant that, did she?
No. But I'm saying that she had the possibility to tell him that because of the protective order, they had several opportunities to have conversations. And although in trial counsel did talk to her, according to her recollection, and she had her investigator interview her, and there was something that was so negative about Hoskins that she chose to not call her. And that is just a strategic decision, especially considering that she had several other witnesses that would testify that the victim was lying at trial and testify to her jealousy and anger with the defendant. So I think while we don't know the specific negative thing, I don't think that that's necessary based on the record and what the post-conviction court held. And further, the defendant specifically told trial counsel that he didn't want his family or the victim's family to be involved, and so she was following the direct wishes of her client. Therefore, as the post-conviction court held, the defendant has failed to show that his trial counsel was deficient. Although this court can resolve the claim on deficient performance alone, I would like to briefly address the prejudice issue. In order to prove prejudice, the defendant must show a reasonable probability that but for the deficient performance, the outcome of the proceeding would have been different. Here, the defendant cannot show this because, as we've discussed, the jury heard numerous witnesses who countered the victim's testimony and testified about the victim's jealousy and anger with the defendant. What trial counsel knew about Hoskins' testimony would only have been cumulative to such testimony that the victim was lying at trial. And further, trial counsel extensively cross-examined the victim and had several witnesses to testify to exactly what Hoskins would have testified to. Finally, even if trial counsel knew that Hoskins would have testified that the victim fabricated the charges, It's not clear that she would have actually called her at trial because it was, again, very risky based on her relationship with the victim and her criminal background. Thus, the defendant suffered no prejudice, and as the post-conviction court determined, the defendant received effective assistance of counsel. If there are no further questions, the people would respectfully request that this court affirm the denial of the defendant's motion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. White. Ms. Ruttenberg, you have a little over 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I'd like to address one of the people's counsel's last remarks, that the defendant didn't want his families involved, and he told trial counsel that if he had to, first of all, that's not in the record. Second of all, if he did tell trial counsel that early on, clearly there was a change in that decision before trial, because the defendant's family members as well as victim's family members were in fact called to trial. Now, I'd like to go back and talk about this alleged computer glitch and just reemphasize that if there was a computer problem that happened years after this trial or after this trial that caused some of the electronic file to be lost, that is irrelevant and immaterial because the entire rest of this file had been printed out and was sitting in the public defender's office. So you'd have to believe that not only did the investigator, in fact, investigate this witness and provide a written report, and the written report was given to defense counsel, but somehow defense counsel printed off her entire file in this case, including all the emails, but neglected somehow to print off this particular report and a particular emails requesting the investigation of this investigator, and that's just not a credible assertion. Now, I'd like to reemphasize, Ms. Hoskins had no difficulty remembering that she was never called by her former lawyer, Ms. Casper, regarding this case. Ms. Casper has some vague memory of a telephone call with Janice Hoskins, but 7 years later, that's not very surprising because Dana Casper used to represent Ms. Hoskins, so of course she's going to have some vague memory of at some point talking to Ms. Hoskins. Now, the speculation about this something negative, there's just no evidence in the record that there was something negative. It can't be this three-way conversation, because there was actually testimony at trial regarding three-way conversations between the defendant while he was incarcerated, and that came out through Joy Singleton's testimony. So clearly, that was not a concern of trial counsel. We could just as easily speculate that the something negative was that Dana Casper was afraid of a conflict of interest because she used to represent Janice Hoskins. And again, a critical thing that is missing from this file, if she had in fact investigated Ms. Hoskins, she should have had a conflicts memo in her file. And that isn't there either. There is nothing in this file from front to back that the ADC post-conviction investigator found and testified to. She found nothing in this file that mentioned Joyce Hoskins at all, except for that protective order. No conflicts memo, no email to the investigator asking to investigate this witness, no report from the investigator that he did in fact investigate this witness, and the entire rest of the file had been printed off in paper prior to this office move where allegedly some computer files were
Redenburg, lost. May I ask you a question about the contents of the file? Didn't defense counsel testify that she had seen somewhere in her notes a reference to Ms. Hoskins?
There were no notes in her file that mentioned Ms. Hoskins.
Did she have access to notes that you didn't have access to?
No.
Okay. Because I thought there was some mention of that, at least. Whether that's credible or not is another issue.
Well, no, excuse me. I back up. I'm sorry, I misspoke. There was a note in the file where the defendant told her about Ms. Hoskins. That is the entire sum total of Ms. Hoskins being mentioned in that file, of her note, of her conversation with the defendant, where the defendant told her about Ms. Hoskins and she was a potentially very important witness. But that's it. After that, there's nothing. No email to investigator asking him to investigate, no written report from the investigator, no conflicts memo from Dana Casper analyzing whether she had a conflict of interest in light of the fact that she used to represent this witness. And again, there was speculation by the People's Counsel that it might have been risky to call her because she might flip. Well, that's just sheer speculation. That wasn't even raised in the trial court. Clearly, that's not the case because Ms. Hoskins was very forceful in her testimony at the 35C hearing that she felt that her niece was lying and that a terrible miscarriage of justice has happened because the defendant was convicted upon the perjured testimony of her niece. And I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Ruttenberg. Thank you again, Ms. White. We appreciate both of your arguments this morning. That concludes the oral arguments this morning for Division 1. The court will be in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.